wonder-working power in the precious...
Incredible as they seem, are not the results of mass hysteria.
You may wish to adjust the dial you're currently tuned into.
The wrong station. From Ptarmigan Magazine, the Spring Issue, 2024. Headline, The Billionaire and the Bell. Deck, Developer's Death Rings a Familiar Tune. It's tough to open a restaurant in Toronto. Asher Farb should know. For nearly a decade, the now 38-year-old Wunderkind has masterminded the founding of feted establishments such as Bar Jaguaro and Maison Demi-Monde. 13 months ago, he met disaster for the first time since 5440 went under in 2016. Belfry was to be the jewel of Farb's restaurant empire. Located on the 60th floor of Colby Tower, the vistas alone justified extravagance. While sipping on their $90 old fashions, Toronto's great and good would be able to gaze out upon the far-flung darkness of Toronto Islands, the wide sliver of the lake at twilight. The menu, on its textured paper, was crafted by the tattooed hands of none other than Green Goose's Matt Spencer, who you'll be able to catch on HBO's The Pitt this fall. It featured updated Canadian classics, including bison steaks and braised venison chuck burgers, just like we used to enjoy Grandma's house, I'm sure. Interior design was masterminded by the Montreal firm Blackout and incorporated sleeknesses of mid-century wood and brass, along with a subtle sacramental theme. The red lanterns and their wrought iron sconces were salvaged from a desanctified Anglican church, now condos, as was the restaurant's centerpiece, an enormous 4,900-weight black bronze bell suspended from a thick beam over a pool of water. Funding for the restaurant came from a small number of hand-picked investors. Notable among them was real estate developer Richard Bogard Jr., 64, who died on the restaurant's opening night. The Billionaire. Not far from Holland Marsh, Fenstoke St. Peter's, St. Pete's for those in the know, has slightly more people today than it did when Richard Bogard's father, also named Richard Bogard, moved there after the war. But St. Pete's has had an uneven half century. Throughout the 90s and 2000s, this town was hollowed out completely. Rebecca Gates has lived in St. Pete's since she was a child. She saw the small farmers get bought out by the big ones, and then deindustrialization carry off most of what remained of the jobs. People just left. The heart went out of this community. When they tore down the church, that was the end of it. It's only since the pandemic people started to come back, but mostly they commute. They live here, but their lives aren't here. Rebecca remembers Richard, though. He was a nice boy, small for his age, always very quiet. I knew his father was in real estate, but Richard was always, head in the clouds. He'd sit in the church for hours and draw the stained glass angels. Such a good eye for detail. I thought he was destined to be an artist. Never would have thought he'd become, Richard Bogard. Never in a million years. The Bell. Sometime around 1746, a Dutchman named Van Zyl arrived in London. Van Zyl was a bell founder by trade, and his arrival in England was shrouded in controversy. According to those with contacts in the Low Countries, he'd fled across the Channel shortly after the murder of a high-ranking member of the States General. Van Zyl, it was rumored, had been sleeping with the man's wife. Nevertheless, the bell founder was, according to one contemporary, a tall and comely man, charming in speech, pleasing in hygiene, and masterful in the art and science of casting bells. Perhaps unsurprisingly, bellfounding was a trade where good looks, and apparently hygiene, were not universal. And so Van Zyl, this 18th century Hemsworth of the bell trade, found people willing to put his skills to use in London. I'm driven to ask, if Van Zyl was a murderer, then was the killing personal or political? He was an outspoken supporter of the House of Orange, and his flight from the Netherlands came only a year before the Dutch Republic was overthrown and the House of Orange reinstated. Perhaps it doesn't matter. Van Zyl would never live to see the Restoration either way. Less than a year after his arrival in London, the trunnion on a crucible broke while Van Zyl was recasting an antique bell. The molten bronze splashed, and a bolus of liquid metal caught him in the stomach. It took him several days to die. The Bogarts. 2 and a bit centuries later, another Dutchman was attending Upper Canada College. If you ever saw Richard Bogart interviewed on TV, or read profiles of him in the financial pages, you might be forgiven for thinking his was the story of the Canadian dream, a hard-working immigrant's son who made good. And appealing though this narrative may be, the facts tell a slightly different story. It is true, as Bogart once said on Lang and O'Leary, that his father arrived in this country with no property, nothing at all. It's also true, however, that 6 months after his arrival, Bogart Sr. purchased a large property outside of Fenstoke, St. Peter's. No mere post-war bungalow, the house in question was a stone manse which had once belonged to the Lieutenant Governor. So, we know Richard Bogart Sr. had money. Where that money came from is anyone's guess. With so many records lost during the war, Richard Sr. is a ghost, up until the point where he shows up in Canada. But, of course, in a country like ours, money isn't always enough. Parish records show Bogart Sr. was affiliated with the Dutch Reformed Church when he first arrived in Canada. Then, sometime around the mid-50s, he seems to have abruptly converted to Anglicanism. Perhaps he just saw the light. But conversion certainly seemed to have improved his prospects. 2 years after joining the local parish, he was married to the daughter of a member of provincial parliament. 2 years after that, we find him in a photograph taken at Toronto's exclusive Albany Club, shaking hands with Conservative Party leader George A. Drew. Then, in 1974, we find his son, Richard Bogart Jr., enrolled for 1 year at Upper Canada College. 3 of his classmates from that year would go on to be cabinet ministers. Maybe Richard Jr. truly did feel like he started out with nothing. Born and raised in the country, he might have felt out of step with his more urbane classmates at UCC. There are institutions with warmer reputations, after all. Andrew Barnett Charles, MP Westlake Kroll, was a classmate and friend of Bogart's at UCC. Like Rebecca Gates, he remembers Richard as a quiet young man who mostly kept to himself. Unlike Rebecca, he never remembers him drawing. The Bad End of Ishmael Sadler. Around a century before Van Zyl fled to London, a roundhead fifth monarchist named Ishmael Sadler lined 13 people up and had them shot in the town square of Chipping Hayes, a swampside village in East Anglia. According to Daniel Fairstow in his monumental textbook, Campanology, this was at least the third time Sadler had turned his soldiers' guns against the innocent. It would be the last time. Being opposed to what they saw as the idolatry of religious symbols, the Roundheads routinely broke stained glass windows and defaced religious murals. Hardliners, and Ishmael Sadler was a hardliner, extended this intolerance even toward such objects as church bells. As it happened, the church at Chipping Hayes was locally famous for its height and fine stonework, and its bell tower housed a notable bell. This instrument was dated 1238, and the inscription around its curve read, "Abbot Thomas Madime, for the quaint bronze of Ferkitel, the bloody bell of Abbot Wolfstein." Wolfstein is an Anglo-Saxon name, and so the bell may have already been several centuries old by 1238. Bloody Bell, of course, rings ominously. It may be that Thurketel's name was already tightly connected with violent death by the time that bell was recast in the 13th century. Ishmael Sadler, of course, didn't stop to consider the bell's history. He sent his men up to the tower to cut it down. And when they saw through the rope, down it came, smashing through 3 floors of dry timber and sending a hail of splinters through the tower's open door. Not splinters like the kind you pull with tweezers, but the kind that killed sailors on Napoleonic battleships. Slivers the size and width of your arm. One of those splinters buried itself 8 inches deep into Ishmael Sadler's throat. But the bell was broken, and it would be an entire century before a Dutchman named Van Zyl would be hired to refound it. The building boom. Men like Richard Bogard do things the right way. They don't launch risky ventures right out of school. They graduate with honors from Queen's University and find themselves an entry-level position at a reputable firm. They learn the ropes, develop skills, work long hours, and climb their way up to the ranks. Then, when they're ready, they strike out on their own. When men, like Richard Bogard, make it, it's because they're smart and decent and hardworking, not because of any connections or advantages they may have. To suggest otherwise would be unfair, even slanderous. Libelous, technically, if you printed it in the pages of Ptarmigan magazine. Richard Bogard did things the right way. After graduating with honors from the Queen's University School of Business, he found a job at the development firm Goldenrod & Associates. David Goldenrod was an Albany Club associate of Bogard's father, but of course was not responsible for hiring decisions at the firm. After 5 years working for Goldenrod, Richard and a school friend found some family members willing to invest and pooled their resources to buy a small set of rental units. People who knew them then describe a cycle of frugal living, new capital, and further acquisitions. Once Richard's portfolio was in the low tens of millions, in 1980s dollars, he partnered with a business associate to purchase and develop a strip of farmland outside of Brampton, single-family residential homes. In other words, sprawl. The project turned out to be profitable, so he did it again, rolling the debt forward as you're supposed to do, unless you're the sort of person society tells to avoid debt. He gradually built his portfolio until its sheer value dwarfed any of those debts. Where did Bogard's capital come from? Almost exclusively from other private investors, some of them, like Goldenrod himself, Bogard's father's friends. Where did those investors get their money? Almost exclusively from their own real estate deals or speculative investments. And where did the money come from to cover the startup costs of those archaic deals? Here we enter the realm of speculation. But those mid-century Albany Club photos show Richard's father brushing shoulders with Colbys and Kincaids, Allens and Lascelles, captains of industry in mining, forestry, and oil. But what happens when we ask the question one more time? Where did their startup capital come from? The startup capital for the startup capital for the startup capital. Just how exactly does a family get rich in the British Empire at the turn of the 19th century? There are a number of answers to that question, but all of them would be unfair, even slanderous to state. Libelous, technically, if you printed them in the pages of Ptarmigan magazine. But whatever the answers, what do they matter? The Middle Passage and the plunder of India weren't Richard Bogard's fault, and neither were the expropriations of St. John's from the poor or the Grand River Tract from the Haudenosaunee. And it wasn't Richard Bogard's fault when rents had to go up and the tenants didn't like it, or when wetlands had to turn into driveways and the endangered birds didn't like it, or when old buildings had to be redeveloped and the people living there protested, "This is our home." None of these things were his fault. Of course they weren't. But he did become tremendously rich off of them. When Richard Bogard was 48 years old, he bought a piece of land in Fenstoke St. Peter's, where it turned out that the old Anglican church of St. Agathus still stood, the very church where he'd spent so many hours drawing angels as a child. Or, and maybe this is another way of looking at the evidence, he bought that piece of land because St. Agathus was standing on it. There's a picture that I came across while researching this story. It was in an old parish directory which Rebecca Gates gave to me, an overexposed photograph of a young Bogard standing out in front of that church. He's wearing an overstarched white shirt, a pair of gray flannel pants, and a blue blazer. I grew up wearing the same clothes each Sunday. I know just how they scratch your skin, just how the blazer always carries that faint smell of mothballs. Behind him towers the great Victorian darkness of that church. And, just glimpsed in the tower at the far right upper corner, the dark suggestion of a bell. The beginning. Rebecca Gates remembers an incident from her childhood. It involves that parish bell. There was an old man at the church, George Garcy. He was a widower and had been a part-time custodian at the church when he was younger. But that was before I was born. He was well into his 80s by the time I remember him. Not many people in Fenstoke St. Peter remember George Garcy anymore. Those who do recall a small, milky-eyed man who sat in the same chair of the parish hall for hours in the early morning before church services began, and hours into the afternoon after they'd ended. We always had to ask him to go when it was time to lock up. James Frobisher, another former part-time custodian at St. Agatha's, was 20 years old when Mr. Garcy died. He'd always say, "Can't you just leave me to close up behind you?" We'd have to tell him, "Sorry, George, you don't work here anymore. You've got to go home." The only newspaper record of George Garcy I can find might offer a clue as to why he didn't like to go home. It's a clipping from the Fenstoke Messenger Gazette, April 13th, 1932. "Tragic death," the paper announces. "Mary Garcy, 22, of Stone Row, Fenstoke, was found drowned this morning in the quarry pond behind Claggan Line. Mrs. Garcy appears to have received a head injury before her death. Police say they cannot rule out foul play at this point in the investigation. Mrs. Garcy's husband, George, 41, has been brought in for questioning, and police are asking for information about the whereabouts of an unnamed vagrant, described as dark-haired and of sallow skin, who was seen in the area the night before Mrs. Garcy's discovery." George Garcy was quickly released. The unnamed vagrant, an indigenous man from Six Nations named John General, had been apprehended in the next village over. Court documents identify General as having been born in the township of Caledonia, which now, almost a century later, remains central to disputes between the Six Nations of Haudenosaunee and developers like Richard Bogard. Developers say the town, like most of the Grand River watershed, was ceded to the government in the 1800s. Six Nations says the land was only ever leased, and that they're owed about two centuries of back rent. Over the decades, this land dispute has frequently become violent. And, if you wanted to, you could think of John General as one of the victims of that violence. Despite his unwavering protestations of innocence, he was convicted of Mary Garcy's murder, and later hanged at the Don Jail. Despite the fact that George Garcy no longer worked for St. Agatha's, it seems he still owned a set of the church's keys. On the day of his death, he took a group of boys up the bell tower so they could look out on the town below. On the way back down, it seems, one of those boys rang the bell. What child wouldn't have been tempted to? But in the enclosed space of a belfry, the ringing of a 4,900-weight bell is incredibly loud. The noise seems to have startled Mr. Garcy at the top of the steps, and at his age, the fall could not have been anything but fatal. He was dead well before the reverberations faded away. Interestingly, none of the boys ever claimed to have known which of the others, if any, had been responsible for pulling on the rope. Also, interestingly, one of the boys in that tower on that fateful Sunday afternoon was Richard Bogard Jr. The belfry. On the belfry's opening night, everything was perfect. Food was flying out of the kitchen, the drinks were fucking killer, and everyone was there. The mayor, people I can't even fucking tell you about without breaking an NDA. Everyone. Asher Farb still gets a faraway look when he talks about the belfry. It was like, this is it. We finally fucking made it. 5440? Forgotten. Gone. We were all the way back, and the future was fucking limitless. He recalls seeing Bogard only once before his death that evening, near the beginning of the night. "I made sure to track him down. You know, it was a lot of his own money in the place, so you have to, like, pay respects." He found Bogard drinking a steam whistle at the edge of the water feature, alone in the noise of laughter and clinking cocktail glasses. "He was just looking at the bell," says Farb. Right now, if you have the connections, you can still get into the empty restaurant and see that bell hanging there. Heavy, silent in the slanting afternoon sun, the movement of the AC across its open mouth giving the faint impression of a sound of whetted steel. The space is all in legal limbo now, the branding, the assets. And so for now, the bell just waits. Asher remembers Richard asking where he'd gotten the bell from. I told him, I don't know, have to ask Larry. That's Larry Easterman of Blackout Design. He said something about finding it buried in a scrapyard somewhere. Pretty good, huh? He always finds good pieces. I don't know how. At this, Farb says Richard got a funny sort of look on his face. He said, maybe the good pieces find him, Asher. I thought that was a decent joke at the time. Opening night puts a lot of demands on a restaurateur's attention. Someone from the kitchen showed up at Farb's elbow. Maddie Spence needed him for a moment. Asher was already making his excuses when Richard grabbed hold of his arm. I was surprised. He never did that. Never, like, broke your personal space like that. And he was stronger than he looked. It actually hurt a little bit. He asked me, hey, Asher, do you think I could ring that bell? I always wanted to. Well, I'd always wanted to let people ring the bell, but Larry talked me out of it. Do you have any idea how loud a 4,900-weight bell can be in an enclosed space? He told me. So I said to Richard, sorry, man, Larry saw you coming. They took out the ringer in there. Clapper is the word Asher actually means to use, at least according to Daniel Fairstow's monumental textbook, Campanology. The bronze clapper is what makes the bell actually ring, and according to Asher, the one at Belfry had been removed. Which makes what happened next interesting, to say the least. After Asher returned to the kitchen, Richard Bogard did something nobody would have expected. He'd always been a quiet, backroom kind of guy. No showman, not by any stretch of the imagination. But that night, in front of the great and good of John Torrey's Toronto, he climbed over the polished brass railing and clambered down into the water feature, ruining his handmade loafers. Several people laughed. A few young women cheered and raised drinks. Someone shouted, go get him, Richard. But everyone who was there that night says Bogard just stood in the water, staring up at the bell, at the darkness beneath it. A friend of mine, who was waiting tables that night, says he reached up and ran his fingers along the letters stamped into the curve of the bell. It was a weird moment, she tells me. The whole room just went quiet, like we all knew something was going to happen. I won't share my friend's name, by the way. She's left Belfry off her resume. Then he just turns to us and says, you want to hear me ring this bell? Most people remained silent, it seems. A few drunk television producers cheered him on, but their voices fell flat in the odd silence that had descended. Back in the noisy kitchen, Asher Farb was too busy arguing with his celebrity chef to notice what was happening outside. Richard Bogard reached up. He took hold of the rope which was hanging down from inside the bell, felt the weight of the bronze clapper attached to it, and swung. It's tough to get a sense of what the noise was like. Most people who were there say things like, I can't describe it, or it was unlike anything I'd ever heard. But the physical evidence speaks clearly. 53 people from that room ended up in the hospital that night. At least 20 suffered ruptured eardrums. My friend, who was waiting tables, has suffered from tinnitus ever since. Even in the kitchen, Asher Farb says the sound was unbelievable. Matt and I threw ourselves on the floor. We thought a bomb had gone off. Standing inside the empty restaurant today, that's almost what it looks like happened. Half the windows were shattered and thrown into the sky by that terrible sound, their shards slicing down on the heads of pedestrians far below. Today, the abandoned space stands dim from the plywood sheets which cover up those floor-to-ceiling vistas, those wide views of the unceded Toronto Islands. Several eyewitnesses claim they saw steam rising from the water's surface as the bell's sound died away. I spoke to Margaret Sawai, a professor of applied physics at TMU, and she assures me that the described phenomenon is impossible. Yet, nonetheless, still standing and wreathed in that steam, Richard Bogard Jr. developer, friend to the great and good, wearing a bitter smile on his face. As silence swept back into the room like a wave, he fell backward into the smoking water and never moved again. The cause of death was cardiac arrest. A perfectly normal death for a man his age to die. Bronze. As I stand in the empty shell of the restaurant, in the dusty sun of the side windows, I can understand why Richard Bogard would want to ring that bell. It seems to call in the silence, but when I reach up to touch cold bronze, there's no clapper waiting for me in the darkness. The bell hangs mute and silent. Why it spoke for him that night, I can't claim to know. But it seems he went to that bell gladly. So maybe he knew. It's Thurcatel, of course, that hangs in the empty restaurant. That ancient bell, recast, remolded, and rebroken and shipped across the sea and demolished in its tower and buried alive under scrap and dredged to life again for the edification of the belfry's patrons. An old friend. Old foe, perhaps. A bell he'd sat beneath so many hours as a child, drawing angels in the parish windows. The Wrong Station is made possible with the generous support of our listeners on Patreon. Visit today at patreon.com/thewrongstation. You can also support us by leaving a rating and review on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever it is you tune into the show. This week's episode, Belfry, was written by Alexander Saxton and performed by Anthony Botello. Thank you to Jay Harrison, Allie Katz, Atax, Tulip's Mom, Sophie, Caden O'Sullivan, Doug Carlson, Jotun, and a very special thanks to Rebecca Gates for helping us keep the lights, well, off. The Wrong Station is co-produced by Alexander Saxton, Anthony Botello, and Jacob Duarte Spiel, with music composed and performed by Alan Citrin, and arranged for the viola and performed by Viola Schmidt. You can follow The Wrong Station on social media, at The Wrong Station, and email us at thewrongstation@gmail.com. And until next time, thank you for listening.